Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number anyone may call for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody followed by the number 8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. What is the solution to homelessness? Is it just waiting for housing to be built? Or should homeless people squat on abandoned properties or build tent cities where they can fend for themselves? What is the solution for the Gulf Coast? There's a Gulf Coast Civic Works Act currently pending in Congress, and a lot of people are fighting for it. But even if it passes, will it be enough? We'll talk about these and other potential solutions right after this.
When I begin to fall so low, I didn't have a friend and no place to go. So if I ever get my hand on a dollar again, I'm gonna hold on to it till them eagles grin. Nobody knows you when you die.
Just outside Boston, the Cambridge Gateway Inn sits along a busy highway next to a bowling alley. Rooms here go for $89 a night and include a free continental breakfast. The state is putting up nearly 600 homeless families in motels like this because the shelters are full. The place is dated and a little dreary, but a single mother who just checked in says it's better than being on the street. She showed up here with a sack of clothes and some children's books, a pink plastic piggy bank, and a can of Chef Boyardee lasagna.
My name's Jen. I have two kids. My daughter's 9. My son is 6. He has really severe autism.
Jen didn't want to give her last name because she's never been homeless before, and she's worried about deterring prospective new landlords or employers. She misses a lot of work when her son gets sick or acts out at school.
I lose my job constantly because of my son's disability, you know. I finally got evicted, and when I had no place else absolutely to go earlier today, I went to the transitional assistance office and asked them to put me into a shelter.
I've never, ever seen this at this level, these numbers of people entering shelter so rapidly in every month.
Robin Frost runs the Massachusetts Coalition for the Homeless. She says she's hearing from more people who've lost their homes or apartments to foreclosure. And Frost says that, combined with the slow economy and the rising cost of living, means families who've been scraping by are becoming homeless.
I wish I didn't say this, but I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg. We haven't even turned on the heat yet. You know, we're anticipating calls of families that, and individuals that aren't unable to put oil in their tanks for their houses.
Philip Mangano is executive director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness.
There's no question that what is happening in Massachusetts is happening in a number of other places in our country.
Mangano says at least 725,000 Americans are homeless on any given night. In recent years, the country was having some success at reducing that number because of local initiatives to end homelessness. Mangano hopes that progress will continue when the economy recovers.
There are in place strategies and a new national mindset, and that mindset is this is a problem that can be solved, and we need to apply the political will and resources necessary to get that job done.
He says in the meantime, some states are using existing funds to buy foreclosed properties and convert them to subsidized housing for the homeless. But Massachusetts is one of more than 24 states that are facing budget shortfalls in the billions this fiscal year.
This is an environment in which it is much better to invest in helping people stay where they are for as long as possible.
Marilyn Anderson Chase oversees the state's Department of Transitional Assistance and its emergency shelter program. She wants the state to help more people avoid homelessness.
I visited one of our offices this morning and sat in on an intake with a young woman who presented with an eviction notice. Had she contacted us 4 months ago when she was first apprised that she was at risk of losing her subsidized unit for non-payment of rent, we would have been able to help her.
But since the woman has been evicted, Chase says there's not much her agency can do. It's run out of vouchers to subsidize rental housing for others. Chase admits the state has no emergency plan if homelessness gets much worse, and people are still streaming into shelters and staying longer. That means more nights in hotels for people like Jen and her kids.
I'm already on a million wait lists because I knew that I couldn't afford regular permanent housing in my particular situation right now. Maybe someday I can.
For now, she says she'll be lucky if she can get by until she can collect unemployment. And that check is still weeks away.
This story is rebroadcast with permission and was reported for NPR News by Shannon Mullen.
Nobody knows you when you down and out.
Back to the Homelessness Marathon. Now in its 10th hour, I'm Michael, your host. I'm here with co-host Abby, Harmon.
I'll just call you Mikey Diddle.
Oh, sounds good. Sounds good.
All right.
So the topic of this hour is going to be solutions. What are some possible solutions out there for this epidemic that's currently going on in this country?
Now, I think that this hour comes at a really nice time. I mean, we just finished up with an hour of Why We Agitate with some of the best agitators in the country, Paul Bowden and Sherry Honkala.
Indeed.
And we want to follow that up with talking about some other concrete solutions.
And we have a guest on the line, Selena Kilmoyer, volunteer with Camp Quixote and director of a Women and Children's Center. You with us, Selena?
Yes, I am. I'm right here.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
What's the name of the Women and Children's Center that you're the director of?
I'm the coordinator at the Out of the Woods Family Shelter. And it's called Out of the Woods because we literally started finding people living in the woods behind the house that the Unitarian Universalist Congregation Church here in Olympia owned. And it's now been, over a period of time, converted into a family shelter for families with primarily little people.
And Selena, we would like to talk with you a little bit about Camp Quixote. Now, I understand from talking with you before that you have been with this project since the planning stages?
Yes.
And
Yes?
I was just going to ask, could you tell us a little bit about it?
Certainly. Camp Quixote started as a protest. The city council here in Olympia, which is the capital of the state of Washington, decided that one way to deter the homeless from being downtown would be to create an ordinance which prohibited people from sitting or lying on the sidewalk. And in protest to that, a group of advocates and homeless folks did some planning, got some energy flowing, and set up a campsite on city property right in downtown Olympia. The city officials didn't like it. The city police didn't like it. And by the end of a week, the camp was being threatened to be taken over by police force. So the Unitarian Universalists on the west side of Olympia offered sanctuary to the campers. And we were not the first congregation in Washington to do this. There are other tent cities in the Seattle, Washington area and have been for a number of years. And they have sometimes peacefully coexisted on church properties and sometimes not so. So we began, that was 2 years ago, February. And since then, there has been a rotation of churches that that accept the tent city. Since then as well, Olympia and one of the other neighboring jurisdictions have passed ordinances condoning tent city. And a third one is considering it, and our county is also considering it. And I see what we have been doing by creating a safe environment whereby residents self-govern and learn how to do that, and learn how to live and solve their own problems. They are safe. They can support each other. And the communities around where tent cities have been located have just been so enlightened by the opportunity to actually meet people who experience homelessness and find out that these people are really no different than they are. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience for the most part.
Now, Selena, that's very interesting that you would use the word enlightened for neighbors next to a tent city. Now, so often we hear the term NIMBY instead, not in my backyard. And I'm wondering, did you encounter any of that after the tent city was established?
We have. Part of the ordinance requires that the neighborhood be notified 30 days before the tent city arrives. They have to be given handbill, hand-delivered handbills announcing that the camp is coming. 2 weeks prior to its coming, there has to be a neighborhood meeting held. And there are several of the churches that are, have now hosted the camp twice. The first time around, every church public meeting was just 2 hours of hell. I mean, people were just so afraid of so many myths about homelessness, and just a horrible experience. And yet the second round, because they had had the experience, they had gotten to know people as people, at most maybe one person would show up for the neighborhood meeting, and that would probably be because he or she was new in the neighborhood. There was no criticism, there was no fallout at all after the first initial educational period.
All right.
Pretty amazing stuff.
We also have another guest on the line we want to bring in, Joe Palinkas with Dignity Village. Are you there, Joe?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Joe. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you. It's good to be able to get out.
I'm wondering, we've been asking Selena to fill us in a little bit on Camp Quixote and its beginnings, and I hear some similarities in the stories, one of them being these anti-camping ordinances, and I believe that that was the case in Portland with the beginnings of Dignity Village. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
From what I understand, the city had to lift a ban that they had put on for stop people from camping, and I wasn't a participant in all that happened at that time. It's just something that I've happened to hear while I've been here at Dignity Village.
Well, I'll confess, Joe, I have a little bit of an obsession with Dignity Village, and I have in my possession a Tent Cities Toolkit. It's a DVD that was put together that really outlined the beginnings of Dignity Village, and one of the really important things is that they got an anti-camping ordinance overturned in the city, and that was really the way that really paved the way for Dignity Village to exist. As I understand it.
Yes, that was a major stepping stone for the people of Dignity Village to create their village in the surroundings that they wanted. Majority of the people that worked really hard to help get that overturned, and people were very excited that it when it got overturned.
Yeah. Now, I want to say, for those of you who have just started listening, you are listening to the Homelessness Marathon. I'm here with my co-host, Michael, and I am Abby. And we have two representatives of two different tent cities, one from Olympia, Washington, Camp Quixote, and the other from Portland, Oregon, called Dignity Village. And we want to sort of start a conversation with the two of you. Now, we're in the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and what we have down here is, you know, a disaster of immense proportions. And people are trying to rebuild. Now, there has been a Gulf Coast Civic Works Act introduced. And what that is a very holistic, long-term, comprehensive plan. But tent cities offer a temporary, short-term solution. So we're wondering, since you have such expertise with the tent cities, what advice would you have for the people in the Mississippi Gulf Coast?
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, you know, it's hard to say because I know that I'm talking to a lot of people from around the world that's actually come out to the Dignity Village and listening to different problems that people have about setting up tent cities. I think the biggest problem is finding the property to be able to set up and not be able to be an issue with the surrounding neighbors. And I think that if that was possible to have a piece of land and a piece that they could be used that wouldn't interfere with the neighbors, I think that would probably be their biggest challenge.
Well, I think it's certainly one of the things you look at here in the Gulf Coast is that people's neighbors are in the same boat. There are a lot of people here with property and no housing on that. It's just all been wiped out. So I think, you know, certainly maybe we could look at some way of incorporating a tent city with that. If maybe neighborhoods could band together.
I know one of the issues, just to chime in on that, Michael, one of the issues has been that the local governments have had very tight restrictions on rebuilding, on what you can rebuild on your land. And I know that that's been a major impediment. Do either of you, can you weigh in on that issue, on how you get over that?
One suggestion I would make is to utilize the resource of faith communities in your area. I mean, churches are constitutionally sanctioned to be able to house homeless people as part of their mission. So the federal law protects churches. And the first step would be what we're doing here in Olympia would be to establish tent city or tent cities on church property, create a self-governing model, which Dignity Village also incorporates, and to be able to demonstrate that people living together can nurture each other, support each other, and provide the safety network that they need and neighbors as well need in the time of crisis that you all are experiencing. Because without that sense of community, without that sense of safety net, I just can't imagine the stress level that everybody's living under in your area. So I would say start with that as step one, as we're doing, and then evolve into more tent cities as needed, and then further evolve into acquiring leased property even prior to being able to buy permanent property. But the whole idea is to be able to, I think, do as we're doing here, creating one tent city that can be replicated as a very viable, temporary, cost-effective alternative for transitional housing.
Does such a thing as a blueprint exist that people can try and find on how to establish a tent city? I mean, are there any kind of resources where, you know, somebody, oh, you know, we can go, you know, Google this and say, hey, all right, well, this is how we do it?
There isn't, to my knowledge. I know Dignity Village has some literature available and all. I mean, all we have is just our lived experience, which we are more than willing to share to anyone, with anyone.
Do you want to give out some?
Possibly can.
Do you want to give out some information as how people might contact you?
I will gladly give my email, and that's small case letter K dot Selena, S-E-L-E-N-A, at gmail.com.
Okay, that was k.selena at gmail.com?
Yes.
Great.
And I certainly would respond to anyone with questions about what we did and how we're doing it.
Joe, does Dignity Village have any kind of publications or something that people can take a look at?
Other than the Tent City Toolkit, you know, our website has a lot of history on it as well, as to how we started and some of the things that we, you know, we've done to create the village over, you know, since day one.
You want to give out the web address so people can log on and take a look?
Yeah, that's dignityvillage.org. And in the menu column, they can also go to Tent City Toolkit link, and it'll take them to the Tent City Toolkit. So that will allow them to purchase a copy, which is a DVD thing, and so pretty much if they log on to the website, they could read further into the into our website. A lot of it is open to the public, but some of it's open to members only.
And I have to say that beyond the Tent Cities Toolkit, I had the occasion to visit Dignity Village last summer, and I have to say, it is an experience that I had not had before. To be in a village that people had created themselves, there's something really amazing about that.
Yeah, the village itself, it is basically a concept of homeless people's idea of dignity, and, you know, and as we progress along, we try to maintain that ability of allowing people to use their skills, and we encourage people to learn new skills of building and stuff like that, so that when people progress and move on, they leave behind their own work for some other person to come in off the street and to be able to update it and things like that.
All right. We have somebody here standing at the mic. Your name, sir?
Warren.
Warren. How you doing, Warren?
Pretty good, thank you.
If there were some sort of tent city in this area, Would you try and be a part of it?
You betcha.
And why is that, Warren?
Well, I think we all need a place to live. I mean, it's just part of life where you have a cover over your head, food in your stomach, and maybe that would bring a smile to a lot of our faces.
And one of the things that Abby and I were discussing before we started this hour is looking at some sort of way to transition from a tent city into some kind of more permanent housing, whether, you know, it be training people with skills and building housing and creating jobs that way. You know, I mean, what are you doing now? Where are you living now?
Well, I like to say we have beachfront property, but unfortunately we don't. We exist where we can.
Yeah.
And their favorite line is down here, out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
Yeah, it's the politicians and the people of power. If we don't see you, we don't hear from you, you don't exist.
But now,
Warren, I'm here to say that we do exist. And I'm sort of shaking up here right now, but we do exist, and we are humans, and all we ask is a little chance in life.
I wholeheartedly second that, Warren. Now, I believe you said that you are a contractor. Is that correct?
I'm a retired contractor. I was a carpenter by trade for 40 years, and I came down here to help people, but with all the paperwork that's involved with certain people trying to get at least one room done so they have a roof over their heads and a place to call home. It's so hard to get a permit these days for any kind of work.
Now, are they making it really difficult for you? Is it just so many loopholes you got to jump through to get anything done?
Well, the paperwork. You know, you fill out one form, come back next week, fill out another form, come back the following week, another form. And by the time it's all said and done, you got a stack of papers and you're starting from scratch one.
Now, Selena and Joe, do you guys also run into a lot of obstacles in terms of having to juggle the bureaucracy to get things going?
My experience is very interesting. Here in Olympia, there was one of the city council members, who was particularly vehemently opposed to anything that had to do with homelessness for many, many years. And he was publicly outspoken about it, et cetera, et cetera. He got an invitation to come and host at Camp Quixote. We have a security table at the camp 24/7. And it's manned by volunteers from outside the community as well as the community members themselves. Anyway, this councilman was invited to just come and hang out at the host tent, and he got to know some of the people. He is now one of our strongest, most ardent advocates. And he publicly will praise the camp and what's going on, et cetera, and it's absolutely amazing.
Well, it certainly goes to show that, seeing something firsthand will definitely change your mind.
Right, and this was a guy who went on a tour to Dignity Village with a group of other local politicians, came back bad-mouthing it from here to next week, and today he's one of our strongest advocates. So it's about perseverance, you know, it really is. And what we have found is to just keep going back and to try not to going back to city council in anger, but in ways that will try to bridge the gaps in our understandings and our perceptions, and to just keep working at growing some kind of relationship. And it's awfully hard to do for people who have been kicked in the face time and time again to stand up and say, we forgive and now we still have needs. You know, please listen to us.
Absolutely. Now, Joe, I'm wondering, now it's a bit of a different situation in Portland because you are actually on public land. How have you all navigated the bureaucracy of the city?
Well, the city is actually requiring us now, to do, if we want to build any more of community buildings, and things like that, we have to have everything coded as far as blueprints and all that good stuff. And so we're having to work with the city if we want to expand our village to that next level. So the city has actually allowed us to work with building our own structures for a simple reason. They're only a certain size limit. And, which are built in your normal, typical 2x4 construction. And so the city has worked with, you know, with us and give us a few guidelines to follow. And so we pretty much, you know, followed what we, the guidelines that we had and progressed along with that.
Okay. Well, I'm wondering, how does this sound to you, Warren? Does this sound like a familiar story or does it sound kind of foreign?
Well, it's a familiar story for any of the building on the coast. The bureaucracy, they could just simplify some of the processes, and so you don't have all these loopholes you have to jump through. I really don't understand some of the building codes as they are, with FEMA, MEMA. They keep on adding more and more and more to the point where no one knows what's going on or how to build. And with that, there's more paperwork, more time, and that means the people can't get in their houses.
Well, it is definitely a complicated situation down here. Since Katrina, I mean, FEMA has, you know, had their brand of emergency assistance. MEMA, which is the Mississippi state version of FEMA, they've had their own brand of assistance and a host of rules and regulations to go with each one.
And I want to just take a moment here. For those of you who are just joining us, we are in the 10th hour of the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon. You can call in at 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And I do want to thank you, Warren, for coming up and talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Warren. Now, back to you Tent City experts here. I'm wondering, have either of you had experience with other forms of, shall we call, alternative solutions to ending homelessness? Urban homesteading, squatting, these things often go hand in hand in cities that will accept tent cities. Have either of you experienced this?
I coordinated. I worked for a different nonprofit for several years and ended up, I guess by default, coordinating what was a very substandard, very impractical, very uncoded, unzoned properly men's shelter. And we
tell us how you really feel, Selena.
Excuse me?
I said, tell us how you really feel.
Anyway, it was a hell of a place. But we packed 45 to 50 men in every night and did that for almost 3 years. And it was probably much, much worse in many ways than Camp Quixote. But that experience helped me to be able to communicate with the men and women who first lived in Camp Quixote to understand what it means, regardless of what, you know, what your environment is, the importance of building community. Because the guys at the old shelter were able to do that. And it was a horrific experience. But we just kept on, and the city would come around sniffing and complaining, and we'd just ignore, and we were able to hold on to that until one of the big nonprofits in the area finally saw the wisdom in developing a comprehensive facility for the chronically homeless single men and women in our community. And that has replaced the old substandard, rat-infested, wonderful place we used to call home. But we had that experience. And the men appreciated that substandard place because they had nothing prior to that.
Joe, what about you?
And I don't know if I... Excuse me?
I was asking Joe if he'd had similar experiences.
I really haven't had any similar experience, but, you know, from being here at the village, I can understand her point and the feelings of a lot of people that have come to live in Dignity Village that have lived in various places throughout the United States. To be very true with society of how they look upon homelessness and how they try to solve homelessness. And I think that they don't do enough to help complete the circle. I think there's a lot of loopholes they leave open, and it's a problem that I don't think they'll ever really be able to fix.
Okay, now, this example that you use, Selena, I'm struck by the contrast between the what I'm assuming to be a government-funded shelter. Is that correct?
It was partially funded, yes.
Okay. And a completely grassroots tent city. Now,
yes.
One of the guests that we had on earlier today, Dennis Culhane, is a professor of social policy at University of Pennsylvania. And he recently published, some might call an inflammatory article, I would call it provocative, saying, you know, are we actually reallocating the lifeboats, or are we just rearranging the deck chairs of this whole homelessness problem? And the stance that he takes in this article is that what we are doing is simply tossing good money after bad money, or bad money after good money. I don't remember the exact expression. But because it costs so much money to put somebody in a shelter, when it's much simpler, much cheaper to keep somebody in their apartment, not to mention the psychological and mental trauma that you avoid by doing that. And I guess I see tent cities as being something very similar to that, where you give people a chance to not just, you know, to use the corny psychological terms, take control of your own life, but to actually have the tools to do that. I wonder what you think about that, Selena.
I agree. I have watched a number of people, because they've had the safety of the community of Tent City, and that's the biggest underlying piece, I think, here, have been able to get their act together and to determine what they need to do next and to be able to move on. And that's so important, and yet it's amazingly cost-effective. It costs for the porta-potties and the garbage and the, you know, the electricity and whatever else that we're plugged into, it costs about $12,000 a year.
Okay, that is now, just fantastic.
There's a lot of in-kind stuff that comes through the church, the faith community that happens to be hosting for the three-month period. But nonetheless, $12,000 when it costs millions to build these permanent facilities
to
house the homeless. So, I mean, in terms of cost effectiveness, it's fantastic. Even to build simple structures, as Dignity Village is doing, still is amazingly cheap. You know,
I think it offers an opportunity for the community to get in on the goodwill. I mean, I remember on the tour of Dignity Village, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but did the local fire department donate the heaters, or was it some other organization?
Yes, the local fire department did donate the heaters, and they also came back probably a couple months afterwards and donated enough lumber to finish up some of the structures that were only covered up by tarps still.
Okay.
I want to give out those numbers again. 877-NOBODY-8 and 866-LEFT-OUT. If you have a solution you'd like to propose, give us a call. We have a gentleman at the mic. Your name, sir? How you doing, Randall?
I'm from Waveland down here, where y'all are broadcasting, next to Pass Christian. I've been listening about this Tent City idea, which would be a wonderful thing down here if we could. Number one, our problem would be getting the politicians to donate the public land. Number two, they would probably make us put the Tent City 18 foot in the air and get insurance on it. So that would be difficult for us to do down here, although it is a wonderful idea if we would be, you know, 5-10 miles, well, 10 miles inland. But in this area, it's not an option for a tent city, realistically. But we need it down here. Like I say, my story is I spent 7 months in a tent after Hurricane Katrina. Between tents, I was, I would say I slept in minimum of 15 different places till I got my MEMA trailer, which I lived in for 3 months. They moved me to another one I lived in for 1 year. They moved me into another one I lived into for a couple of months. Then the formaldehyde issue come up. I had to move out of that into a hotel. We stayed in a hotel for 2 months. And during this time, you know, I took my FEMA money and I bought property with it. I was a renter before the storm. So I bought property trying to better my life, seeing that, you know, that a lot of people were getting a little bit of assistance. And I thought maybe I would be eligible for some. So I bought this property and they finally get me out the hotel and give me one of the MEMA cottages. And then Hurricane Gustav comes along. Well, I didn't get any water in my cottage and they condemned it. The insurance company come by and condemned it. And I fought it for about 6 weeks, 2 months, but they took that away. And they did put me in an apartment. 2 months later, the assistance runs out. And when they negotiated me off my property into the apartment, because I was refusing to leave, they promised me 18 months of assistance till they could help me buy one. And if I could show them, I had $30,000 to put it at mine, actually, where I live, 18 foot in the air, which is impossible. I don't have that kind of money. I'm on disability. And so, you know, now I'm in an apartment with a promise of 18 months of assistance till maybe they can come up with some kind of an answer. After 2 months, they cut me off. So I had to pretty much call them and beg, you know, hey, I've got 22 days till I'm back on the street. And, you know, negotiated with them some more. And I did get, you know, 90 days more of assistance. And I'm sitting here living day to day wondering what's going to happen after these 90 days, because I did have some volunteers, God bless them, show up today. For my first help since the storm that I asked for, you know, I finally asked for some help because I couldn't do it on my own. I had some volunteers show up today, and they're actually in the process. By tomorrow or the next day, they're going to finish an 8x10 shed for me. And if worse comes to worse, when these 90 days run out, at least I have that 8x10 shed. It's about the same size as the MEMA cottage, and I can survive in that. But, I mean, if you don't do it on your own, by now, if you haven't had the help, I doubt if it's coming.
And what I'm struck by in your story is just the constant upheaval. I mean, as if Katrina wasn't enough.
It's like a short-term solution after short-term solution that isn't a solution at all.
Well, the storm after the storm was actually worse than Katrina, to be quite honest with you. Hurricane Hancock County, Hurricane Waveland, Bay St. Louis, the rules and stipulations. That's the hurricane that I'm fighting now, and it's a heck of a lot worse than that 30-foot storm surge that come through, let me tell you, because I was there for it, and it wasn't pretty. But all the stuff we've been going through afterwards is worse. I mean, I am definitely been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome from this. And, you know, it's just hard to function. And you know, you wake up with nightmares and cold sweats and you can't think straight. You know, it's hard to work under those conditions, you know. I mean, I get out there and hustle what I can and save what I can. I'm doing the right things with money. You know, the money I got from Katrina, I bought property with it. And now, if this assistance runs out, I can't afford the apartment and the land. And not to mention, I got my name on a lease, which I'm risking losing my disability because I have an asset with the property now. So if they catch me, I lose my disability, but I'm having to do what I have to do to survive. And
it does sound like the local, state, and federal government have launched quite a coordinated response on taking people's options away.
Correct. My just insight on this is just they don't want the people who couldn't afford to build their houses back without the insurance and stuff like that. And they are selling all this beach property, anticipating condominiums and high rises. And they want it to look like Miami, Florida eventually, probably. So they want the lower income people out of here. That's what the problem is. If you can, you know, if you have money, you can afford to get over their loopholes and their code restrictions and all that. But they do not want us here, because if we're here, the money's not going to come here with the condominiums and things like that, you know.
Right, right.
And then the less people that own houses here, the less people going to gripe about the government and what they're doing with the situation here.
Now, so. Given Randall's story, I want to pose a question to Joe and Selena. Have you encountered this sort of animosity to poor people in your cities?
I would say obviously not as dramatically and not as hugely as you're experiencing in your area. But there is very much discrimination against the poor, the marginalized, the homeless, many, many ways. There has been, I've only been in Olympia Town for 10 years, and there has been an ongoing effort to move people from downtown Olympia because it is our capital city. You know, they want it to be a show place.
Right.
They want the homeless to be invisible and to be somewhere else. And it has been one thing after another after another in an effort to get the homeless gone. The police enforcement in the municipalities have done sweeps on campsites in the woodlands. People are harassed downtown. Homeless people are not allowed to hang out in the parks. I mean, it goes on and on and on, much smaller than the epidemic of poverty you're experiencing.
Right.
But I think every area will be experiencing just a huge, huge tsunami wave of poverty washing over and over and over in this current decade.
I think you're absolutely right. And what is heartening, perhaps the only silver lining on this cloud, is to talk to you all who are on the line, hearing that there are alternatives, that cities, even though they want to have the picture-perfect city, the waterfront walking with all wealthy people, even though that is the reality there, you have managed to get a tent city as a solution to homelessness. And that, to me, is a silver lining in this story.
All right, I want to thank you, Randall, for coming up and talking to us. We're going to go to the phones here quickly. We have Henry from New Mexico. Henry, do we have Henry?
Hello.
Hi, Henry. How are you doing?
Hi, Henry.
Hey, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Oh, well, this is Rick from Vallejo here in the Bay Area, California.
Oh, well, Rick, how you doing?
Well, we want you to.
Hey, no problem. I was in New Mexico a long time ago. Hey, you know, I'm about 18 months into being homeless, and I was listening to one of the callers, and she used a phrase which was, gives them a chance to get their act together. I'm sure she meant it, you know, in a nice way, but it made me think of this supposition that if you're homeless, you've done something wrong, or you're doing something wrong. And I could say from experience, that's not the case with me, and I don't think it's the case with a lot of people. I think there's a lot of failures going on in our country, especially in the last couple of decades, and there's a great deal of us who are being pushed into homelessness, no matter what we do. For example, I worked about a decade on a paramedic ambulance in Oakland. My back got hurt. So the company I worked for, AMR, they hire a lawyer to fight me for years. It's not a good time to do that with what's going on with the economy. I'd already had all what would have been my assets disappear from our family court system, which is another place where a lot of people that would normally have resources to handle shocks have that ability taken away from them, unfortunately. It doesn't seem to be really helping families. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Absolutely. And Rick, right?
Yes, Rick.
Rick, I have to say that from my experience, I have not been homeless, but I have many friends who have been, and I can tell you, they would second your opinion on that. It's funny that we insist on blaming an individual when we have a system out there that, you know, that really works hard to keep people down.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I am, and I'm not surprised I'm here. I'm not surprised because I saw so much of it growing up and so much of it on duty in Oakland. But at the same time, I think I even bought into that little, oh, you know, if you get the job where you're doing good with a little bit of status and your life's going to go along and you're going to always have somewhere to sleep that's got four walls and electricity and a bathroom. And I think all of us kind of need to wake up and stop buying into that as well as the other part of that script, which is, oh, that's never going to happen to you because those are the bad people who made mistakes, and start all just looking at each other like, hey, we're all here. And if we really want to look at why we're here, look up. Look at those people that are in charge. Don't look around you. Don't point at each other. Say
well
hi
put,
to each other.
Well put,
talk
Rick.
About it.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Rick.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having this radio show. You know, hopefully some people will listen.
Absolutely. We try and get to, you know, as many people as we can. It's a
no doubt.
It's a big problem, and slowly but surely we're gonna you know, do what we can to find solutions, try and solve this problem. I want to go back to Joe. Joe, do you have, you know, maybe some advice for people how they should maybe band together, what they can do as a community of homeless to form some kind of alliance to better their situation together?
You know, I think that that is the only way that they're going to create anything, is to just join together, join forces, and pursue every obstacle that comes in their way with some sort of solution and answer. And they can create their own tent cities in wherever, whatever environment that they're put into, make the best of it, you know. And it's not going to be an overnight success, but it'll be a stepping stone. And with a little bit of hard work and a lot of effort, it'll create itself and, you know, blossom out. I only wish that the cities and the state governments, you know, would be a little more lenient as to allowing, you know, helping out in donating a little property or whatever type of situation to where, you know, the homelessness can help take care of themselves. And, you know, because people end up homelessness for one or two reasons, and majority of the time, it's not their fault. But, you know, once they get into that status, it's very hard to get out.
Absolutely.
Certainly. I think we have Henry back on the line. Henry, are you there? Henry, well, we seem to have lost.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hi, Henry.
Okay, my comments might be irrelevant or whimsical. They usually are. If so, I apologize to Rick and Randall. I dialed left out or nobody. Emily Dickinson said, I'm a nobody. Are you a nobody, too? I lived in a cardboard box in an alley in Chinatown. The stigma of mental illness is alive and well, even in the clinics, where the doctors are evangelical Republicans or straight to the point of stupidity or just plain incompetent bureaucrats. I was raped 50 times before I was 5 years old. Any psychiatrist compounded the rape with a misdiagnosis. My IQ is said to be between 71 and 181, depending on how many espresso coffees I've had. But I speak on behalf of the enormously misunderstood who don't qualify for a home unless they have an address.
Yeah.
The stigma is that if you're honest about being insane in an insane world, you're discredited. You have no credit. Van Gogh had no credit. I have no credit. And I've ate nothing but air and Beethoven for a week. End of statement. Good heavens to you.
Thank you,
Thank
Henry.
Thank you so much, Henry. And we are always glad for a perspective that shows the sane-ism that we have in this country that you can compare to racism or heterosexism, any of the other isms that we so cling to in this nation.
We are getting close to the end of the hour here. Selena, is there any advice that you would offer to the people who are trying to just find something temporary or temporary leading to permanent, some kind of situation to no longer be in the turmoil that they found themselves in?
One of the things I'm not hearing from any of your telephone guests is really utilizing the resources of the faith communities in the area, because, as I said at the top of the hour, churches constitutionally have the right to have and house tent cities on their property. I mean, that's a right given to all churches in the United States, and that would be a safe haven for the folks who are waiting for the dream of public land to be given. You know, it's not going to happen for many, many of the homeless. So we need to be where there's possibility, and church property is that possibility.
I think that's a point very well taken. Very well taken, Selena. And the community that we are in the Mississippi Gulf Coast has a very strong community of faith, and I think that that is a point well taken for the people in the Gulf Coast area. And Joe, I wonder if you would have any final comments for us, what you would tell the people or what you would tell the politicians here.
Well, I would like to see all of our government step up and realize that homelessness is a major problem. And with the economy the way it is now today, there's going to be more and more homeless people out there. And I know that they're struggling right now to get the economy turned around. But as things are going, more and more people are hitting the streets daily. And so the government should really take a look at the homeless people and see what they can do to help the homeless as well.
Right on. I do want to thank our guests, Joe Palinkas and Selena Kilmoyer, for joining us during this hour where we've been discussing solutions. We are heading towards a break. Joe, before we go on break, do you want to give out your website again?
Yes. That is dignityvillage.org. And you can read all about the Dignity Village.
All right. Those numbers again to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 and 866-LEFT-OUT. We are going to go into a short break. Please stay tuned and join us when we return.
WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.